What's up, you guys? I'm Andrea.
And I'm Haley.
And you're listening to Inhuman, a true crime podcast. Okay, so last episode, we discussed Edmund Kemper, his life, the diabolical relationship that he had with his parents, as well as his first two victims, which were his grandparents, Maud and Edmund Sr. Now, today we are going to cover the other eight victims that met their fate at the hands of Edmund Kemper. So, again, I'm going to give a trigger warning because I really went back and forth with how much detail I wanted to share about his crimes, but the gruesomeness of it is what he did, and so I left a lot of it in. I did leave some of it out, but the majority of it, I did leave it in, so sorry ahead of time, but if you know Edmund, you know, you already know.
Yeah.
Okay, so on May 7th, 1972, Ed was driving in Berkeley, which was where his mother worked. She was actually a receptionist, or I don't know what they called it back then, like a secretary type thing. At UCSC.
University of Santa Cruz. University of California, Santa Cruz.
Yeah.
I applied there and visited there. Did you know that their mascot is a banana slug?
A what?
Banana slug.
A banana slug. I didn't even know that was a thing. A banana slug. All right. Is it poisonous? Anything?
I have no clue. But it is a really pretty campus, and the UC or the Santa Cruz Pier, which is not far from it, is really fun. Beautiful area.
Awesome. So he was driving in Berkeley, which is where his mother was working, and he picked up two co-eds, which I don't particularly like the term co-ed because it describes women, college-age women specifically, but it was very prevalent in this time because this was when women were starting to be, like, more independent and they were going to college, and but I feel like it's kind of like a sexualized term now.
Yeah, it kind of is.
See, like, you know, Girls Gone Wild, co-eds or whatever and stuff like that. So I don't like that term, but.
Yeah.
So he picked up two college girls, Mary Ann Pesky and Anita Mary Luchessa, who were hitchhiking from Fresno State University. The two 18-year-old young women were headed to Stanford University and willingly got into Ed's car. You know, seemed like a nice guy. Hitchhiking is the way.
Yeah.
He offered them a ride and they accepted. After driving for about an hour, Ed managed to reach a secluded wooded area with which he was familiar with from his work with the highway department. There, he handcuffed Mary Ann and then locked Anita in the trunk. He proceeded to stab and strangle Mary Ann, and then he did the same horrible acts to Anita. It's reported that Mary Ann was a tough girl and put up a fight, but sadly, she didn't stand a chance against this massive creature. Yeah. So in one of his interviews, he talked about how big and bright and beautiful, like, her eyes were. Like, she had big blue eyes. And that's basically why he picked her.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, in a later interview, Ed admitted that while handcuffing Mary Ann, he accidentally brushed the back of his hand against one of her breasts, and it embarrassed him.
Oh, wow.
Adding that he said, "Whoops, I'm sorry," or something like that. But then he went on to murder her just minutes later.
Jeez.
Yeah. So, that kind of shows you a little bit of the turmoil of the good and the evil that he kind of combated with.
Yeah, 100%.
After he killed both young women, he placed their bodies in the trunk of his car and returned to his apartment. On his way there, he was actually stopped by a police officer for having a broken taillight, But since the officer obviously was unaware of anything, he let Edmund leave.
Wow. I hate that whenever that happens, like somebody gets pulled over when they're in the middle of murdering somebody. Oh, it makes me so mad.
Did that happen with Israel Keyes? Was it?
I'm totally blanking on if it did or not. But it's definitely happened with people. I feel like it might have even happened with Ted Bundy. We haven't covered him yet, but
yeah,
I feel like it happened with him.
Probably. So Ed's roommate was not home that day, so he took the bodies into his apartment, where he proceeded to photograph them, have sexual intercourse with their bodies, and then dismembered them.
That is sick.
He then put the body parts into plastic bags, which he later abandoned near... Now, you might have to help me with this one. I looked it up, and I said it like 16 times to the point where Manny was saying it too. Loma Prieta Mountain?
Oh, I have no clue. It sounds right.
Okay.
That's so funny. I can just imagine Manny repeating that.
Yeah. I said it so many times because I was like... I was trying to make sure I pronounce everything right because, you know, I want to do this case justice, do the victims justice. Yeah. And even though it doesn't really matter where, you know, the mountain was called. But so before disposing of their heads, because he did decapitate them, he engaged in oral sex with their heads.
That I have no words. What a sick fuck.
When Mary Ann's head was discovered the following August, an extensive search failed to turn up the bodies or the head of Anita. Their other remains of both women have never been found.
Yeah, that's so sad.
I know. His next victim was only 15 years old. Her name was Aiko Koo. Aiko was a Korean young lady. She was a performance dancer. She was an only child and was raised by her single mother.
Oh my god.
On September 14th, 1972, Aiko decided to hitchhike home after dance class rather than wait for the bus, which appeared to be running late. Again, like his other victims, Ed took her to a wooded area. He actually flashed his gun to try to impress her or scare her. And then he foolishly ended up locking himself out of his car. But Aiko reluctantly let him back in. He then choked her until she was unconscious, raped, and killed her. He placed her body in the trunk of his car and then went to a nearby bar to have a few drinks. Afterwards, he returned to his apartment where he again photographed and had sexual intercourse with her body. Ed dismembered her in his bathtub and disposed of Aiko's remains in a similar way as his previous two victims. Aiko's mother called the police right away to report her daughter missing when she didn't arrive home that evening. She put up hundreds of flyers asking for any information, but nothing came of her efforts.
That's so heartbreaking.
You know, she was the youngest victim.
Yeah.
After Aiko's murder, Ed ended up moving back in with his mother.
That's so, like, you're murdering people. And then you're like, I'm just going to move back home with mom.
I from what I understand is he didn't have a good grasp on, like, his spending. And so he would kind of be forced to move back in with her. And even when he lived on his own, like, she was always around. Like, she would just show up at his house unannounced. She would call him incessantly. And it was just, you know, it was always stressing him out. But unfortunately, he had nowhere else to go. So he had to move back in with her.
Wow. Okay.
In January of 1973, a woman's torso and hand washed up on a beach near the Santa Cruz Pier. You're just talking about that.
Yep.
Ed had picked up another hitchhiker, 18-year-old Cindy Shaw. Cindy was a college student at Cabrillo College and was a nanny. She was working to save money for a car, but unfortunately was left to hitchhike to get around. Ed fatally shot Cindy in the head. Again, he dismembered her body. And the following day, he threw the parts into the ocean. This next part is so incredibly fucked up. He kept her head for several days before burying it in his mother's backyard. And it's reported that he admitted to cutting her face off of her head and placing it on top of the grave so she would always be looking up at him.
What the fuck? Wow. That's so, like you said, so fucked up.
Yeah. Cindy's family found out about her death on the news.
Oh my God.
She left behind a brother and a sister, and her sister was never the same after hearing about what happened to Sydney.
Yeah.
She sadly went on to become a drug addict and died of an overdose when she was 33 years old.
That's so heartbreaking.
I know. After this murder, Ed's mom and younger sister began to suspect that possibly Ed could have something to do with the murders that were occurring in the area. Alan went as far as asking Ed if he had anything to do with it, and he said to her, quote, I figured you'd ask me about that. I thought you'd get suspicious. Mom was suspicious too. So don't even talk to her about it, because it'll just turn into a big mess.
Okay.
To me, that would be like a huge red flag. Like, you're kind of admitting to it, but yeah. So as we can see through these killings, Ed has developed a modus operandi, or an MO, that involved shooting, stabbing, smothering, and or strangling his victims, taking their bodies back to his home where he would have oral and vaginal sex with the women and then dissect and dismember them.
Jesus.
He also admitted... there's a bug. Sorry. The gnats are back. He also admitted to consuming the flesh of his victims, but later retracted the statement.
Jeez.
When asked in later interviews why he decapitated his victims, Ed replied, the prettiest part of a good-looking woman is her head. He also referred back to medieval times when knights would slay and decapitate their enemies and use their head as trophies.
That's so sick.
Yeah. So in a way, like, that's what he was doing.
Yeah.
He was defiling them in the worst ways and using their heads as trophies.
Yeah, that's disgusting.
His next two victims came after an explosive argument with his mother. On February 5th, 1973, Ed drove to the UCSC campus using a parking sticker his mother had given him. There, he offered a ride to two students, 23-year-old Rosalind Thorpe and 20-year-old Alice Liu. It's reported that Alice actually got picked up after Rosalind, and she would not have gotten into the vehicle if her friend had not been in the car as well. Because she was very, very apprehensive and reluctant to hitchhike because of what was going on.
Right.
And a lot of the girls in the area were, like, one of the documentaries I watched, they were, like, interviewing the quote-unquote co-eds, and they were like, yeah, we're only taking rides from women, or we're only riding, like, in pairs. And
right.
And even that wasn't, I mean, these girls are in pairs. The first two girls were in pairs. Like, that's not really a fail-safe.
Yeah.
So Rosalind was described by her friends as an all-American feminist lesbian who made excellent pies, which I just thought was kind of...
I love that.
...cute. And they were saying, like, you know, because of the times, like, you could be all of those things. Like, it wasn't, you know, bad juju or whatever to come out and, you know, as a lesbian and being a feminist and also be all American.
Yeah.
Alice was a member of the Future Teachers Club. She served as treasurer of the California Scholarship Federation. She was an officer in the Creative Writing Club, French Club, and Interclub Council. She was also a member of the Tartar Ladies Service Organization. Alice also worked at a local coffee shop.
Wow, she did a lot.
Not long after Ed picked up the two young women on campus, he shot them both. Then he drove past campus security at the gates.
Oh my God.
After the murders, Ed went against his normal MO and he decapitated these two women in his car.
Oh.
He then took them and further dismembered their bodies, removed the bullets from their heads, and disposed of their remains in different locations.
Was there a reason that he changed his MO on this one?
If there was, he never came forward as to why. I think partially maybe because he was living with his mother.
Oh, so he couldn't necessarily do it in the house?
Well, he still took them back and dismembered their bodies there.
Right.
So I don't know. I really don't know. I mean, he never came forward and said, like, oh, this is why I did it this way. It's just...
Right.
Maybe it was what he was feeling in the heat of the moment. I don't know. So a large-scale search took place after Rosalind and Alice, went missing. And it wasn't long before parts of their bodies were discovered east of Castro Valley. It was an unfortunate time because while Ed was committing his murders, another serial killer, Herbert Mullins, was also perpetuating his own crimes in the area. This resulted in Santa Cruz receiving the nickname the murder capital of the world in the press.
Oh my God.
So for Ed's part, he was officially, as we know, named the co-ed killer or the co-ed butcher because the people he killed were considered co-eds, aka college women. Mullins had committed 10 murders during the time, and Ed killed 8. At first, police assumed all the murders were connected, but after they eventually arrested Mullins and figured out his MO didn't include dismemberment, they realized that they had another serial killer on their hands, which, duh, like, half the people are, you know, getting dismembered, and then the other half are just getting shot, I think, is what he did. I think he just shot his victims, and, yeah, but, duh, like, that would be the first thing I would ascertain, you know?
Yeah, that's so scary, though, two serial killers in the same area.
There was another one, too. There was another one, and I can't remember his name off the top of my head, but I think he was... he wasn't as active or something, so they didn't, there wasn't a lot of, like, muddying the water with him. But he was, you know, doing his thing around the same time, yeah.
Wow.
Ed's final murders allowed him to finally realize the revenge he sought after most of his life. On April 20th, 1973, Ed entered his mother's room, where he found her sitting on her bed, reading a book. She said to him, I suppose you're going to want to sit up all night and talk. And Ed replied, no, good night. He left her room and waited for her to fall asleep. During his wait, he grappled back and forth with the idea of whether or not to murder his mother. After an hour or so, the darkness won. He returned to his mother's room. He cuts her throat and beats her repeatedly with a claw hammer.
Oh my God.
As he had with his other victims, he then decapitated his mother. He cut off her hands. He also removed her tongue and her larynx and put it down the garbage disposal.
Larynx.
What did I say?
Larynx.
Larynx. I don't know why I said it. Larynx. Her tongue and her larynx. Larynx.
Larynx.
Larynx. I can't say that word, okay?
Larynx. But geez, down the garbage disposal? What the fuck?
Ed was amused with himself and later said that it seemed appropriate, seeing as she bitched and screamed and yelled at him over so many years.
Oh my God.
He then defiled his mother's head. Afterwards, he screamed at her head for over an hour until he was hoarse and exhausted.
Wow, so he really was getting out all of the pent-up anger.
Yeah, for decades, yeah. He then hid his mother's body parts around the home. Ed called his mother's best friend, Sally Hallett, and invited her over to the house. Ed strangled Sally shortly after she arrived and hid her body in the front room closet.
Why?
He says the reason he murdered Sally was so he could plant the alibi that the two women had gone on a trip for the weekend if they were ever reported missing.
Oh, jeez, okay.
Yeah, so he was, you know, planning ahead.
Yeah.
The next day, Ed fled, driving east until he reached Pueblo, Colorado. He claimed he drove for 28 hours straight. By the way, he killed his mother on Good Friday and turned himself in on Easter Sunday.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So on April 23rd, he made the call to Santa Cruz police to confess his crimes to an officer he knew rather well. He said, quote, You guys all know that I'm the one that did it, and you're all going to kill me. He said, I killed my mother, and I'm in Pueblo, Colorado. At first, they did not believe that the guy they knew as Big Ed could have done these horrible things.
Wow, yeah.
So when police were arrived on scene to Clarnell's home, they were hit with the smell of death. Because at this point, it had been a couple of days.
Yeah.
They searched the home and found her room a massacre. There was blood everywhere, and several body parts had been found scattered in various places around the room. On the bed was a confession letter. It read, quote, not sloppy, just incomplete, gents. Just a lack of time. Got things to do. Approximately 5:15 a.m. Saturday. No need for her to suffer anymore at the hands of this horrible, murderous butcher. It was quick, asleep, no pain.
Okay. Good for you. Like.
Yeah. Like, thanks for taking that, you know, off our hands. Yeah. I don't know. So, Mickey Aluffy, who was an officer with the Santa Cruz Sheriff's Department, and another officer flew out to Colorado to pick Ed up so he could return to California and face his crimes. They interrogated Ed for 5 to 6 hours, and he gave them all the grisly details and the locations of where the bodies were disposed. And then it was fully confirmed that Edmund Kemper was, in fact, the co-ed killer.
Wow.
In October of 1973, Ed was indicted on 8 counts of first-degree murder. He was assigned the Chief Public Defender of Santa Cruz County, Attorney Jim Jackson. Due to Ed's explicit and detailed confession, his counsel's only option was to plead not guilty by reason of insanity.
Oh, wow. So he didn't even want to plead guilty?
Yeah, his guilt was never in question, only his sanity. So,
wow.
During his incarceration, Ed was interviewed several times by psychiatrists and other professionals. One of the psychiatrists was Dr. Donald Lundy. At one point, sodium amytal was administered to Ed, which has been dubbed the truth serum. During this interview, Ed, this is where he admitted to engaging in cannibalism, but as we know, he later recanted that confession. Yeah. Due to his extremely detailed confessions, his counsel's only option was for him to plead guilty by reason of insanity, but the court-appointed psychiatrist found him to be legally sane.
Oh, okay.
And this was kind of because he knew what he did was wrong. He showed, you know, small levels of, like, guilt, and he turned himself in, so...
Yeah.
On November 1st, Ed took the stand and testified that he killed the women because he wanted them for himself, like possessions. He tried to convince the jury that he was insane because he believed that his actions could only be committed by someone with an abnormal mind.
Okay. It's true, but...
Yeah.
You're not, like, legally insane.
Yeah. On November 8th, the jury of 6 men and 6 women deliberated for 5 hours before declaring Ed guilty on all counts. When asked by the judge what he thought his punishment should be, Ed insisted that he should be tortured to death.
Yeah, I agree, but you can't do that legally.
Yeah. However, capital punishment was temporarily suspended in California at the time, so instead he received 8 consecutive life sentences.
Good.
He was then sent to the California Medical Facility to serve out his time. In the 70s, Ed shared the same prison block with notorious criminals, including the serial killer I mentioned, Herbert Mullen, and murderous cult leader Charles Manson.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. He was, again, a model prisoner and remained in general population. FBI profiler John E. Douglas described Ed as one of the brightest prison inmates he's ever interviewed, saying that he was capable of giving officers a rare insight on violent criminals.
Yeah, wow.
Even Ed himself said that he willingly participated in the interviews to save others like himself from killing and so that society would have a better understanding of serial killers.
Well, that's good at least. At least he did something good.
Yeah. Ed first became eligible for parole in 1979.
What?
1979! mean?
Oh my God.
I'm like, are you kidding me? Are you kidding me? So this is 6 years after he went to jail. He's eligible for parole.
I know he couldn't get a death sentence, but how did he not get life without parole? Like, excuse me?
I'm saying. So luckily he was denied. And he was also denied in 1980, 1981, and 1982.
Okay.
After those denials, Ed waived his right to a parole hearing, stating, quote, "Society is not ready in any shape or form for me. I can't fault them for that."
Yeah.
Ed was then denied parole again in 1991 and in 1994. He then waived his right to a hearing in 1997 and again in 2002. He attended his next hearing in 2007, where he was again denied parole. And then he waived his right to a hearing in 2012, and then he was denied in 2017, and he is not eligible again until 2024.
Okay, but, like, that's not that far out. Like,
I know. It's just, like, a few years away.
Yeah.
In prison, Ed was in charge of scheduling other inmates' appointments with psychiatrists. He also mastered the art of crafting ceramic cups. He created tapes for the blind, like books on tapes for the blind. And he spent over 5,000 hours narrating books.
Okay.
So first of all, he loved to talk. I don't know if you knew that about him. Like, he was very chatty Cathy, whatever you want to say. So I could totally see why this was, like, appealing to him. Plus, he has, like, kind of a oddly soothing voice.
Yeah.
In 2015, Ed suffered a stroke and he is now considered medically disabled. Before this, he pretty much agreed to any and all interviews. He did tons and tons of interviews during his time. After this, however, Ed has been keeping to himself mostly, and it's reported by some of the, like, COs that he doesn't even really talk to other inmates.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Edmund Kemper is now 73 years old and is living out the remainder of his days at the California Medical Facility.
I can't believe he's still alive.
I know. I can't either. I mean, I can in a way because, you know, that just seems like that's the way it happens for people like that. And before we close, I just want to remember again the victims and their families. So we have his grandmother and his grandfather, Maude and Ed Kemper, Mary Ann Piskey, Anita Luches, Aiko Ku, Cindy Shaw, Rosalind Thorpe, Alice Liu, Clarnell, his mother, and her friend Sally Hallett.
So sad.
And that, my friends, is the horrifyingly horrific, insane, twisted case of Edmund Kemper, the co-ed killer.
Wow.
And again, I'm going to just mention it because it's just so good. If you guys have not watched Mindhunter, it's actually a book, too. And I did read,
is it really?
I read some excerpts from the book. I didn't actually have time to read the whole entire book because the book is about a bunch of different serial killers like BTK and some other guys. But so I didn't want to, like, you know, read all of it. But I did read, like, excerpts from the stuff about Edmund.
Yeah.
And then there is a really, really, really good documentary. It's called The Coed Killer, Mind of a Monster. And then there's another one that's called Kemper on Kemper, Inside the Mind of a Serial Killer. Both of those are really, really good. People kind of shit on the Coed Killer one because they say that, like, law enforcement, like, put too much of their political opinions in it. But I personally did not think that at all. Like, I thought they did a really good job of covering, like, firsthand accounts of what went down during that time. Yeah. I mean, they interviewed, like, the police that were friends with him, the police that caught him, his sisters, like, psychiatrists. Yeah. Like, and then, of course, they have, like, little clips of his confession tapes, which there's nowhere I could find where all of them are combined. I don't know if they've just never released them, which I could understand why, but
right.
I did listen to, like, several clips from the confession tapes, and
it's just
so fascinating. He's just so...
And you said Mindhunter is the interviews in that are based off of the actual interviews, right?
Right, exactly. Those are actual interviews that did happen with Edmund Kemper. I'm sure they, you know, zhuzhed him up a little bit because it's like, you know,
for
entertainment purposes, but a lot of that stuff really did happen. So, and that guy that plays him, he just did such an immaculate job. I could watch a whole movie of him, like, portraying Edmund Kemper. I know that sounds probably weird, but he did such a good job.
I get what you're saying.
It was so realistic.
Wow, what a creep. And it's just, it's so sad because, like we said in part one, like, he obviously was smart and he had a really shitty childhood and got dealt a really bad hand. And it's just so heartbreaking that, you know, that happened and he couldn't reach the potential. But at the same time, there's a lot of people who are dealt shitty hands and they don't go and murder 8 people. And it's also frustrating, I feel like, with him, because it's like, I mean, obviously, I don't want him to kill anybody, but why couldn't he have just killed his mom? Like, clearly that's who he was upset at.
Yeah. I think, and he did say that like, him killing all of those women was, like, being able to act out his frustrations on them because of his mother.
Right.
But I think he wanted to be loved and accepted by her so desperately bad that it took, like, him coming to the end of his rope.
Because
what happened, from what I understand, was that those were not fulfilling what he was trying, you know, what he was trying to fulfill, which was to kill his mother. And that's why he ultimately decided to kill her.
Yeah, okay, that makes sense.
And her, obviously, all of the murders were brutal, but hers was... I actually accidentally came across some crime scene photos.
Oh, really?
Don't recommend that. Yeah.
Yeah, no.
It was burned into my brain.
Yeah.
But I do, I understand totally where you're coming from, because he ultimately ended up killing her anyway. Like, why not just kill her and get it over with and then just go to prison? But I think for so long he was going back and forth with wanting to be loved by her and have a good relationship with her, but she was toxic and horrible in her own ways, and then it just ultimately ended in the horrible tragedy that it was.
And I guess even if he had killed her first, he might have still had, like, desires to kill afterwards, so I guess we don't know for sure, because he turned himself in after that, but he might have not if it was earlier on.
Right, he might have got a fill of it and been like, I like this, let's do it more, you know.
Right. I'm also honestly surprised that he turned himself in, just because of, like, I am and I'm not, but I just feel like he had too much pride to, like, not want to, I don't know, I feel like he wouldn't have wanted to turn himself in.
I think the guilt was just too much. I think it really was. I think it was really weighing, because, I mean, he drove for, you know, allegedly 28 hours and he was in his own thoughts, you know, and
that's true.
You know, you can really get yourself going one way or the other when you're in your own thoughts after something like tragic happens or something, you know. Obviously I don't have anything to compare it to what he did, you know, but I can understand why he did end up turning himself in, because I think he did have guilt. Like, that's why I don't feel like he, like, part of me is like, okay, he was a psychopath, but I still feel like he was, like, he still had feelings, you know? Like, he still... Yeah.
I honestly feel like he didn't want to kill anybody but his mother, and it was just, or he might have not even wanted to kill his mother, but he was just angry at his mother, and that's why he ended up killing all of these people. But at the same time, that doesn't excuse anything that he did, and he's still a psychopath and a disgusting, evil, horrible human being. And as bad as we feel for him, or him as a child,
right,
there are plenty of people who have shit childhoods and don't do this. So,
to some extent,
exactly. So it's him doing this is also just him, and he should have gotten the help he needed, I guess, but he's still a shit human being and an evil, disgusting monster, and he deserves to rot in jail.
I feel like too, like when he killed his grandparents and they sent him to that mental institution, I feel like that was not, I think that perpetuated everything a little bit more because I think he could have got the help he needed and been semi-rehabilitated. Like, I don't know that for sure. Obviously, we'll never know. But if he had gone somewhere that was a little bit more like for like juveniles and age appropriate, because he learned so much. He even said in later interviews he learned what to do from those sick men. They're like rapists and sex offenders and murderers, and you know, and they're all there because they're insane. And that just doesn't seem like a good place to send a 15-year-old, very impressionable young man.
Yeah, that definitely wasn't the right place for him to go.
I feel like the cards were just stacked against him, and like the nature versus nurture. I think he innately had some of that in him, but then because of his childhood, it just further progressed. And then going to the mental hospital.
Didn't help.
Yeah, it was just all like piled up against him. So, but he ultimately
And
made the
he's poor.
decisions to do what he did, and he deserves to be exactly where he's at. And you know,
And the poor victims that you listed all their names, and I'm sure you'll post photos of all of them because they obviously did not deserve
and you know what's sad is
anything.
like, you know, we always say like we, and I just said light like 7 times, I'm sorry, but we always say how when we cover these cases, we want to highlight the victims as much as possible. And obviously this is a you know, prolific serial killer. Of course, I'm going to dive into his life, his past, his history, everything, because this is what gets us to the end and why he is the way he is. It was so freaking hard to find out any information about these
Anything.
girls. Yeah. Like, I
Yeah, and
really
I
had
think,
to dig to find out the little bits and pieces that I did. And some of it was in the documentaries, but some of it was is just not even
and I feel like
included.
I hadn't even heard all of their names before, and that's just terrible because that's what it's meant to be. So obviously that's why we want to share these stories, and even the bigger and more well-known ones, because a lot of people know the name Edmund Kemper, but a lot of people don't know their names.
I knew some of their names. I remembered some of their names, and I remembered the young girl, Aiko. I remembered her specifically just because she was so young. But yeah, some of the other girls, like I maybe had seen their picture, but you know, I didn't have a name to put with the picture necessarily in my mind until I covered the case. So
And now we won't ever forget their names.
that's right. And I will be posting pictures of them, you know, on our Instagram and our Facebook. And again, like, if you know any more details about this case that I didn't cover, I'd love to hear about it. I'm sure there's people who like spend their days and nights researching cases and stuff, and this one is just so interesting. So if you have any more details, I'd love to hear them. But yeah, that's Edmund fucking Kemper, and I hope you guys enjoyed it the best that you can, because it was not enjoyable for me to research, but it was interesting. It was interesting, especially the psychology side of me was like, oh yeah, like I know these terms and I know that. Can't pronounce larynx, but I know what BPD is. But anyway, I still said it wrong, I
Larynx.
know. I can't. My tongue and my it's it must be because I have a southern twang. I don't know. I'm just gonna blame that for now.
There you go.
But yeah, so thank you guys for listening, and until next week, we'll catch up with you then, and keep it human.
Bye.